Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today's guest is Dr. Maureen Fitzgerald, an associate professor of religious studies at the College of William and Mary, specializing in women, race, religion, and immigration history, much of which will figure into our conversation today. She is also the director of William and Mary's American Studies program. Professor Fitzgerald earned her PhD in history from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and has authored a couple books, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton's Women's Bible and Habits of Compassion, Irish Catholic Nuns and the Origins of New York's Welfare System, 1830 to 1920. She is currently researching and writing on the historical process of secularization in the 20th century America, with emphasis on the body, work, and the transformation of categories of the soul and self. Something to look forward to. We will link to Dr. Fitzgerald's bio on our website, as well as her books for your perusing, so please check them out. Maureen, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I always like to start out by asking my guests how they came upon the topics that they studied, because research is really not just an endpoint, but a process. And I'm wondering how you started out becoming interested in studying Irish nuns during the 19th century. That seems a little bit out of the way topic. So how'd you get there?
Well, I got there. I was in Wisconsin. I was doing my doctorate, and I had finished MA work on Elizabeth Cady Stanton and networks of activists around her and around the question of religion. So the book that you refer to, I write the introduction to a version of the Women's Bible that Northeastern Press put out about 15 years ago, or actually now it's more than 20. But that group, who are relatively well off, have a lot of influence in terms of the women's movement. We always knew that it was a select group. In other words, it was never a massive movement that on a regular basis included working class women, that kind of thing. So one of my concerns after I had finished that work was looking at Irish nuns at the same time and in the same places. And I thought, what are these women thinking as opposed to what this more elite group is doing? And I started really with a relatively modest idea for a dissertation, which was that I would follow up on Hassia Diener's work on Irish women and look at particularly the way in which nuns set up charities for women. And she references this in her book, in Erin's Daughters, which is a great book. And I thought it would be a good dissertation, but not quite as complex as the one that I ended up doing. And I ended up doing that largely because I kept looking for these women's charities, and then the same nuns kept moving into children's charities. Mm-hmm. And I really wasn't understanding what it was, and I had a kind of simple-minded idea about it, that they're not focusing on women anymore, they're doing something more traditional and moving to children. But in reality, that wasn't the story at all. So once I figured out the other story, the women's charities per se, they're still in there, but they have a smaller place in the book than the much larger story about children.
Let me back you up a second. You mentioned Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and I'm not all that familiar with her. The name has come across some of my readings at various points in time. But who is she? And that was that your dissertation work on Elizabeth Cady Stanton, or
no? That was my work on Elizabeth Cady Stanton was more for an MA.
I
worked on the introduction to that book. And really what I was concerned with in that book, because I grew up with a generation, the Elizabeth Cady Stanton work was I had been, you know, I'd always been interested in religion. And here I was in this graduate program. It was the first graduate program on U.S. women's history. And Gerda Lerner had started it. Linda Gordon ended up being my advisor. And these are people who were very important in the women's movement, but not really interested in religion. And they tended, you know, in their mid-80s to be this idea that, you know, religion was just going to wither away somehow. And my thinking about Elizabeth Cady Stanton was that what we were doing as women's historians were we were writing her story about her political involvement in the women's movement of the 19th century. She and Susan B. Anthony were partners. Certainly, Stanton is credited as the intellectual force in that pair, and Susan B. Anthony is the activist force, the one who is organizing everybody together. And what struck me is that Elizabeth Stanton, Cady Stanton was constantly talking about religion, but that was not coming out as very important in the narrative that women's historians were writing. So what I wanted to get into was what is the connection between her religious perspective and her political perspective. And it changed enormously throughout her life, so that she had first grown up as a Presbyterian, definitely was around for the Second Great Awakening, and decided at that point that she was not interested in, or even, well, she'll sometimes write, she's not capable of being saved. But then her husband, who was a senator and very involved in politics, meant that she suddenly got involved in the abolitionist movement through him. And then in the abolitionist movement, she met people like Lucretia Mott in places like an abolitionist convention in London, where they started to talk about the parallel between abolishing slavery and abolishing the laws that made women oppressed. And they saw them as very closely linked, especially have the idea of having property in another person. And so that's where she went. She went to the Quakers, she went to the Unitarians, and increasingly away from any sort of Christian orthodoxy. Mm-hmm.
So you're writing on that, and it, first of all, it's very cool that a master's thesis becomes a book. That's, I mean, congratulations on that, because not many people do that. Usually the master's thesis on the way to the PhD is just something
to do full disclosure, it's what I have is not a full book.
Okay.
I have the introduction to an edition of the Women's Bible.
Yeah, but that's still pretty cool.
That, you know, I just want to make sure I'm not taking credit for
no
her
problem.
Work.
No problem. No, that's still pretty cool, though. So I think that's really neat. And my master's stuff never got published. It got thrown out. So.
Well, you know, what's most important is, you know, the thing is if we have a narrative of Stanton that doesn't include her religious life, mm-hmm. then her turning to the Women's Bible and essentially creating this thing called the Women's Bible, which was essentially taking what she thought and what a review committee thought were the most important parts of the Bible referring to women, and then having commentary on them.
Yeah.
She believed that that was critical to women doing well in America way past her lifetime, because she believed if women were taught that they have to live a certain way in order to be saved in the afterlife, they're never going to move for social change. And what she wanted to argue is that this book might have been inspired by God, but was certainly written by men and has had a very bad effect on women's rights generally. So she was quite controversial in doing this at a relatively late age. But she absolutely wanted a link between her religious and her political views, and they only became more radical over time.
And that then leads you to finding all these Irish nuns in New York City in the early 1800s.
Yes.
Your
yes.
book, I think, is bounded from 1830 to 1920. Tell us a little bit about the focus of place and time that you put on your work. Why New York City, and why these bookends of 1820 to, or 1830 to 1920?
Well, it's a great question. I was actually going to do this in Boston, and I'm glad I decided on New York. And for anybody who's listening who's a graduate student, I just made a completely practical decision, which is that I'm from New York. I have lots of friends and couches that I could use in New York to get the research done, and I started working there. And then I realized it's actually a great story in New York, so I'm so glad that I actually chose to do them. And for me, coming, you know, with the name Maureen Fitzgerald, obviously I have Irish background. And so my question in looking at nuns, I was starting, people in the program especially were working a lot on women in the state and how the state develops. And my question coming in was, all right, we know about these elite women. What do these non-elite women think? And if we're talking about the development of the state and the development of charities in particular, which become part of the state, what is it that these Irish Catholic women are doing? And because so much of the kind of people, the kind of class and ethnic background of someone like Stanton, she's just oblivious to whatever the Irish are going through. I mean, she always has, let's say, in her autobiography, she'll mention some Irish servant, but that Irish servant is a woman who seemingly has no connection to the women's movement. It's Stanton just assumed there would be an Irish servant in her house and that that person had, you know, she wasn't necessarily working for her liberation. Mm-hmm. So the Irish component for me for the Northeast was important at getting at working class views. And what I did is I especially was focusing on the famine migration. And the famine migration, you know, there was very little developed institutional Catholic life before the Irish came. It was very different in terms of ethnicity. But when it did start and these nuns started working, so 30s, 40s, 40s in particular just were terrible because that was the worst decade of the famine, and then that continues into the 50s. And so you have this enormous mass migration of poor people. And among those people are nuns. In other words, they're not separate from the migration. They're a part of it. And they're trying, among other things, to keep folks alive through this migration, which as we can see from looking at a massive migration, let's say, out of the Middle East right now, you know, it's that kind of immediate needs that they were first focused on, is just keeping these people alive. If they get off the boat and they're still alive, how are they going to survive even a few more years? And so that was primarily what their work was focused on. And as you know from reading the book, the first group they really focused on in terms of charities were single women, because single women were often sent out as the first pioneers in the family who could make an independent living and send money back for the next person in chain migration. And so these nuns are coming over. They're working with women, often in the most rudimentary skills.
The issue of women in the migration leading it is really interesting, because a lot of migration is not that way. Usually it's single young men. So is this something unusual that's happening in the 1830s to the Irish?
It is. It's not unique to the Irish. In other words, there are other groups, you know, like even today, for instance, you have a lot of folks who might be doing something very similar to what the Irish did. Women from Mexico who, you know, leave their kids with other family members, and they're working here as a domestic, and they send money home, and they're trying to get a green card. So that's comparable. Very poor people, when they're migrating, tend not to migrate as groups, because they need to send people, but they can't afford to send the entire group. And so if you look at a group that was immigrating at the same time, the Germans, they were relatively well off compared to the Irish, and they did tend to migrate as families. Irish, on the other hand, did not. And you know, they also had, there was a whole ideology around Irish daughters, especially, that they would sacrifice everything to keep the family alive. And so there was not only a market for them, which was domestic service, as it really opened up at this point. But it was a market where the Irish ideology about a good Irish daughter said that you should take whatever little bit of pay you get and send it home. And if, you know, if we compare, for instance, gender norms in these two societies, you know, let's say Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you're talking about a relatively wealthy woman who's very much about individualism, and that's her argument for women's rights. For the Irish, it is really about group survival, and it's a really different perspective. So those single women who went, they're not necessarily arguing for their own individual rights. They're really arguing or working toward the collective survival of the Irish through this period.
Set the table a little bit for us, too. What is New York looking like here in the 1830s, roughly? I mean, they're coming into this country around that time. Is New York already filled with Irish folks, with
no.
other folks? What does
no,
it look like?
You know, the Irish migration started, the bigger migration would be from Northern Ireland and a Scots-Irish. And then by the 30s, you have certainly Irish Catholics, but they tend to be better off. The famine hits in 46. And there's, in terms of the 30s, there's a lot of anti-Catholicism. A lot of people are very worried about all these Catholics coming in, but they didn't expect anything like the famine, where you have a million people leaving Ireland in the process of a decade, another million dies, and these people are desperate. They have nothing by the time they get there. So the 40s changes everything. So, for instance, New York City, the population in that decade between 45 and 55 goes up by another third, and that's in 10 years. It's a lot. And if you think of it, you might imagine a place more like Nairobi right now than you would New York, because the houses, this is where we get shanty towns, the houses were just literally whatever wood they could get, they put together, you know, they slept in cellars. Most of the, two-thirds of the city was completely unsewered at the time, so that really terrible diseases, cholera, typhus, that kind of thing, were rampant. In 48, there was a huge cholera epidemic. And it was considered so dangerous to live in New York City that one of the reasons Irish women in domestic service were prized by the Irish is because they could actually live somewhere where they could survive. They weren't in a cellar where they were very likely to die just because it was such awful conditions. They were living in a nice house. They didn't make much money, but they had room and board paid for them. But the city as a whole was really kind of in shock. In the beginning of the famine, people are often very sympathetic to the Irish. After 10 years of this migration of very, very poor people, people who literally are on the verge of starvation, there's a lot more anxiety about what it's going to mean that the Irish are coming over in these great numbers, or that any group that was this poor was coming over. How is it going to change American society? So it changed over time, but believe me, New York was a kind of very scary place to live at the time.
Yeah. You mentioned that there was some anti-Catholic sentiment, and this, you know, goes back to colonial days and that, when a few Catholics came over. And this, so that tells me that there's some Catholics already in New York City. And so, moving the story along a little bit, the Catholic Church is there. How do they respond to this influx of immigrants?
Well, when we say the church, then we have to, especially historically, be really careful about what we mean. The church was there, as you say, but relatively small compared to what it became. You had, older groups like English Catholics, you had some Irish Catholics, you had French Catholics, especially after the Revolution, but nothing like the numbers that you would have after the Irish come in. And on top of that, what starts to happen in this period is that the Irish hierarchy, the male part of the church, started to become increasingly Irish. And of course, nuns eventually become increasingly Irish. And so it changed everything, and including that it really changed Irish Catholicism, because Irish Catholicism was not a done deal. It was a lot of the folks who migrated to New York or any place in the U.S. or Canada or Australia, they likely did not have access to a highly institutionalized church. These people were mostly from peasant backgrounds. A lot of folks were illiterate. A lot of folks were Irish speakers only and often spoke no English and had very, very little communication with a priest or with an institution of the church up until the famine. It really wasn't developed. Remember that in Ireland, it was not until 1830 that the church was considered legal. It was illegal to practice Catholicism before that. So what instead you had was a mix of Catholicism and Celtic religion that went on as a folk religion and, again, wasn't highly institutionalized. So when the Irish came here, they're not just recreating Irish Catholicism, they're creating something entirely new, which is a highly institutionalized, highly hierarchicalized, again, for lack of a better word, institution that is going to reflect this new society. But it's never purely Irish. It's a different form entirely.
In terms of the hierarchy here, the central focus of your book are on nuns. And so how do the convents play into this? Is this something that's newly developing? Was this something that they had in Ireland? What's going on with the convents?
It's newly developing, and it's developing. The history of nuns goes through several different stages, but certainly what you see prior to the 19th century is you saw a real crackdown on the power of nuns, and it happens both through the Catholic Church and especially on their insistence on enclosure, meaning if you're going to make formal vows in the church for a woman, you're going to be enclosed, meaning your space would be limited to the convent or other places. What that did is that really restricted the ability of nuns to have power. The other part of it is, of course, during the Reformation, many of the convents were closed. What happens in the 19th century in Ireland is that once Catholicism is legalized, so to speak, under British rule, the convents start developing again, and they first start developing from very wealthy women. And initially, they're mostly trained in Europe, and then they come back to Ireland. But increasingly, this becomes the bedrock, convents become the bedrock of both charities and education that are leading to the buildup of the Irish state. So it's not just that you see these religious institutions start, it's that they're intimately connected with how the Irish are building a state that's separate from the British.
And so this is where your story comes into play here, that Irish nuns are coming over. They're mm-hmm. into education, into charity. How does this all start to play out here, and who are some of the key players?
The key players, it's interesting. A lot of unknowns, so to speak, are the key players. By that I mean that if you look at how this develops, it's not so much that any one or two or a handful of individuals were so powerful. It's that the demographics of this movement were so powerful that they really absolutely changed American Catholicism, and they changed the nature of what the Irish were thinking about. Certainly the Irish, in thinking about, let's say, the Irish, or I should say British imperialism, there is a tendency of the Irish to see it all as bad, but the famine was worse. In other words, you can see the potato blight as an act of God. But the Irish increasingly saw the famine, the complete lack of food, and actually various British policies to make them work for that very little bit of food they were getting. But that, they believe that was a state policy that some will talk about as genocide, but certainly will see as horrific. They see that as destroying Ireland. And so coming to the States and then surviving the famine and then being in a position for a relatively long time into the 70s of being among the poorest of the migrants, they're seeing things from the bottom up. You know, they're seeing it from a perspective of great poverty and also of great struggles of these people to not only survive here, but to help their family survive in Ireland. And so it really radically changes their standpoint. So, for instance, let's even take nuns. If you were in Ireland and you wanted to become a nun or a sister, or formally we would say women religious because these are active orders who go out and do things like charities and they have a different name. But if you were not from a wealthy background in Ireland, it was hard to join the church and be anything but a lay sister, meaning that you would do domestic service around the convent, you wouldn't have the same power as more wealthy sisters. In the case of convents in the United States, they could not get any or so few wealthy women to join. And so they had to get rid of those distinctions. And what that ended up meaning was that the people who were joining convents were from working class backgrounds, if not poorer backgrounds. And their perspective was very much in league with the people they were trying to help. So rather than having someone who was very well off trying to figure out how to help you as a poor person, you were having someone who probably grew up very much like you did and then was trying to help.
Some of the groups that you mentioned here, the Sisters of Mercy and Mercy House, they play a big role in here. Who are they and what are they doing? I mean, they're helping you, as you mentioned, they're going to help you, but what does that help look like in the 1840s, 50s?
Well, it's interesting because I'll bring in the other order I talk about in relation to the Sisters of Mercy. The Sisters of Mercy, and I also talk about the Sisters of Good Shepherd. Sisters of Mercy began in Dublin in the 30s, very much by similar kinds of things, increasing poverty, seeing an opportunity to open up Catholic charities, particularly the work of women. And their idea was to provide women with employment or other skills that would allow them to work in New York, usually to help, again, their families of origin. And the idea was always that they are going to save them from going into prostitution. Because if you look at women's paid work at this time, it's very limited. You have sewing, you have domestic service, you have a few other things, but basically the bottom line is that those jobs are very poorly paid, and what is also exploding in this period is prostitution, and it does on both sides of the ocean. In other words, Dublin is rife with prostitution at this point, so is the Eastern Seaboard. The Irish don't like to talk about this. They're very ashamed that that any Irish woman could possibly be involved in prostitution. But it's always the fear. And the reality is we know that those numbers add up on the seaboard. If you're very poor, if you're struggling, if you think your family is literally going to die of starvation, you're going to do a lot of things for work that you might not otherwise. So they always set them up as, we'll train you in domestic service, we'll train you in sewing, this way you get a job and you won't go into prostitution. Sisters of the Good Shepherd work with those women who actually went through the court system and were arrested on charges related to prostitution, and they usually were given a choice. They could either go to the prison or they could go to go to stay with the sisters. And on the one hand, the Sisters of Mercy did an extraordinary thing. They set up the House of Mercy in 1848. It's just the worst. 46 is really the beginning of the famine. 48, it's just terrible. And they end up having, this is before we have Ellis Island. It's before even Castle Garden. So there's no real immigrant depot to kind of say hello to people and orient them. And so these nuns, thinking that those docks are the place where women are most vulnerable, start to recruit them off the docks. They stay with them for maybe a month or two. They teach them basic skills, might teach them basic English, and then they go off and do a job. And the idea is to keep this enormous network going so that that woman who is placed in a domestic service job may likely come back to the House of Mercy to say, okay, I have $10 I want to send to my family. She can't write, but the nuns can, and the nuns can direct it to the parish priest who will get that money to the family. So it ends up with this enormous circle of people who are all doing the same thing, including, let's say, if someone gets into a house where there's another domestic service position available, that servant may come back, ask the sisters who's available, and so then they start this chain where basically everybody is working toward some of the same end. But it's not an easy life by any means. That the nuns made it easier to do this does not make it a great choice at the time.
Now, one of the critical questions that comes up, and this is going to have a big influence on the main thesis of your book, is the funding of these charities.
Yes.
Initially, early on, 1840s, 1850s, where are they getting the money to keep the sisters in food and shelter? Because you got to pay them, and they got to eat and stuff.
Yeah. Initially, it's all private contributions. And one of the ways that sisters organized themselves in the U.S. differently than Europe, for instance, is because they didn't have wealthy women going into convents where they would, you know, bring in a lot of money into the convent. Almost all convents in the U.S. Would have a school attached to even people who worked at charities. The House of the Mercy Sisters is a good example. They did not set themselves up to be an educational order, but like the other orders, lacking the money, what they would do is set up an elite school where they would essentially educate the kids of the elite, and it was a relatively small group, but that money then would be channeled back into money they would use for charities. This changes, of course, by the 60s when the Irish do get control over the city. So, and they start pulling in public funding for that. But initially, no, it's very finite as to how much money they're going to have.
Yeah, and that the 1860s is going to become a fulcrum point here. And I just want to talk about what's going on, too, in the 1850s and into the 1860s. This is an era of the Civil War then. What else is happening here that affects the landscape of charitable work? I mean, you talk something about these school wars and then also Protestants reacting to the Catholics who are coming in the 1840s and 50s.
Well, the big thing for Americans is that, you know, it's a relatively young country, as you know. They are optimistic but unsure how this project is going to go. And what happens with this migration is that they see poverty as possibly becoming a permanent part of the American experiment, and this frightens them to death. And they see it in two ways. One is that the Irish are just so obviously poor. And, you know, by the time they get there, they usually have been very, very poor for years. And so they're really not These are not folks who are looking for the land of, you know, gold and honey. They are looking for, you know, some place to stop and eat. And what Protestant Americans do are two things. One is that they see a poverty they've never seen before, and this is a different ethnic group than they are. And then they see the extent of it with the Irish, and they start to conflate Catholicism and poverty. And the idea that, well, if what makes American Protestants so great is their emphasis on individualism and Republican values, then what must make Irish Catholics so poor must be their Catholicism, because they don't emphasize individualism. They emphasize, at least from Protestant minds, they emphasize obedience, they emphasize hierarchy. These are not good kinds of moral traits to have in a capitalist system. And so, increasingly, there is a kind of conflation between poverty and its development. And it scares this group of people because they haven't seen this degree of poverty before. And Catholicism itself, that if you continue to have future generations conditioned by Catholicism in their eyes, you are going to not just reproduce an Irish Catholic culture, you're going to reproduce poverty itself. And intervening on that level became most important to them. This idea that they could somehow not reproduce it. And their answer for that, of course, was to start taking children away from poor parents, with the idea that poverty was the moral failing of the parents. If you took children away from them and you had them influenced by better people, meaning Protestants, they would be brought up not to be poor anymore. And that intervention where they start in the 50s, certainly this is what some people call the orphan train, but generally it wasn't orphans. It was mostly kids who were poor and their parents, for whatever reason, either agreed or just didn't even know that they had been taken. But they're taken out of the city in extremely large numbers and put into Protestant homes in the Midwest. And this was, for the Irish, shocking, to say the least. And it motivated the sisters, as well as lots of other Irish Catholics, to try and stop this practice.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised about this. I hadn't known very much about it, and it had these really kind of interesting names attached to them, the Child Saver Movement and the Placing Out Movement. You just kind of saw this like super Protestant person flying in with a cape and swooping up this kid and saving him from their family. I mean,
right.
It was a really interesting aspect of your book that like, I was like, wow, I can't believe anybody doing that.
Exactly.
So, yeah,
exactly. It's, you know, and obviously the parallel going on at the same time are Native American boarding schools, and we hear a lot about those, that Native American kids were taken out of, you know, their homes, and they're put into these schools for a long time, and then they're sent back. But we, you know, before I did this, I had no idea the extent of this. I mean, in New York, you're talking about periods, let's say by the 70s, by the 1870s, where they really got the system going. They were taking 10,000 kids a year out of New York City alone.
Mm-hmm.
It's an enormous number.
Yeah.
And it really meant that for poor people, their feelings of vulnerability weren't just about being poor, but being poor meant for these reformers, that the Protestant reformers, that they were at fault in being poor, and now they could lose their children for it.
Mm-hmm. How did the Catholics react to it, most specifically the convents?
Well, they reacted in different ways. Certainly there is an overall, by the early 60s, when this really starts taking off, there are lots of folks who, you know, are just horrified by this, but there's not a lot of, there aren't a lot of solutions. What starts to be a solution ends up being really on a very basic level when you, by 65, when you get to the end of the Civil War and the Irish have some political power, you know, in the ways of a city political machine, they start finding ways to get money to nuns. I mean, this money from the state has been used for all these placing out groups, for all these, quote-unquote, child savers. They've been using money, but they had never intended for any of the state money to go to Catholics. And in fact, one of the big things about the placing out movement is those kids could be put with any group of people. It could be Baptists, you know, Episcopalians, whatever, as long as they weren't Catholic or Jewish. And so when they started the system, they thought it was going to work that way. What the Irish were able to do was essentially, once they took over the city, use those same kind of mechanisms for funding to funnel all this money to nuns. And then nuns started doing what I had talked about initially, which is moving away from just working with women to moving to care for these children in enormous numbers, so that, again, I'll jump a decade, but by the 1880s, you have maybe 15,000 kids at a time who were kept in convents with the idea that then they can't be taken by the placing out folks. But they're kept in convents with the say-so of their parents, and the parents can come and get them whenever they want. So what ends up happening, I call this a revolving door. The convents are not meant to be institutions that keep them for the entirety of their youth. They're just meant to stop them from getting picked up for, by the placing out people. And if they, let's say their parents need money, they don't have it, they can't support the kids right now, put them with the nuns with the idea that they, you know, the nuns will give them back. Mm-hmm. So.
Now, you mentioned something really important here. We touched on this, and this really is a big thrust of the book here. The subtitle of your book being Irish Catholic Nuns and the Origins of New York's Welfare System.
Right.
Something happens in the 1860s, specifically after World War, after the Civil War, that changes the dynamics of politics in New York City and New York State in general, and it changes the way of the funding of these charitable works, and then which then gradually expands into what becomes New York's welfare system. So discuss that.
Oh, that's a it's so complicated. I probably make it too complicated in the book, but let's say that, all right, one factor would be what changes is that by 65, you have a majority of the voting population in New York City is born either in Ireland or in Germany. And so native-borns really lose control of the city machine. That's part of it. And that's where you get the introduction of the Tweed Ring and things like that. But you also get an elite that is looking at charities in general. And this group is very influenced by Britain. It's very influenced by these ideas that charity harms the poor. That if you give them money, and again, this is nothing that will surprise anyone listening, because we still have it today, but the idea is if you give them money, they will not work hard, they'll stay the same people, you're reproducing poverty, because poverty was considered a moral problem. It was not constructed by the state, it was not constructed by the economic system, it was a moral failing of individuals. So the idea for this group of elite people was to certainly continue placing out and to restrict aid to extremely low levels, where the idea was if a person had more than they needed to actually survive, to give them any more than that would encourage them to be lazy and therefore stay in poverty. You know, the Irish didn't buy this at all. they were very, very obvious about it. they could look at their own history and the influence of that kind of British thinking on policies in Ireland, particularly through the famine, the idea that people are starving to death, so they needed a job rather than actual food. And what the nuns start to do, which is really important, and it's more than just a Catholic-Protestant split, was they increasingly attack this core idea that poverty is a moral failing, and that charity that helps people who are in distress is harmful. And they turn that on its head and argue that poverty is created by these larger systems, including the economic system, including one that Americans are doing very well with. The Irish as a group, because they're doing very bad, but very poorly, are not likely to say, okay, it's because of our fault. It's because it's our fault. And so they increasingly see these much larger systems, in British imperialism, how the Irish are treated collectively here, as problems that need to be thought about in a different way. So that the development of charity then is for them not only to strengthen the Irish Catholic community, but to critique a state that is quite terrible to poor people, particularly poor mothers or those parents who are most vulnerable to losing their children, and to argue that on the basis of poverty alone, no one should lose their right to their children. And that becomes probably the most important development that is singularly Irish-American in their way of formulating it, as opposed to simply something from an Irish background.
Mm-hmm. And so how does the funding change during this period of time? I find this story to be, as a political scientist, I find this to be very interesting because it involves Tammany Hall and this guy named Senator Tweed and that.
Yeah.
So tell us that story.
Well, Tammany Hall is, you know, this is Tammany Hall is the great example of a political machine where you don't pretend it's based on democracy and those greater Republican values. You know that it's based on getting the bodies to vote, and then the machines will give away jobs. They'll make sure certain streets are clean. They'll favor certain people at certain times. And again, that also is a threat to American Protestants, because it's certainly not based on democratic or Republican values. It's based on the idea that, you know, if you have more bodies, you'll get more loot, so to speak, and then go on from there. And so American Protestants are pretty horrified by those. But if you look at it from the bottom up, you can see a lot of folks who certainly these machines were, the people who ran them, they were out for themselves, but they did give a lot of cover, both legal and political, to folks in the city who were trying to do something different. And they ended up getting a lot of funds to people who were doing something different, especially the nuns. So you and I probably could talk for hours about, you know, how different academics have seen these machines and whether or not they ever did anything good for the poor, who they said they were going to do for. And it's spotty. It's not, you know, there's nothing consistent here. But in this case, once the nuns got the money, they knew exactly what they wanted to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
They went crazy and, you know, just developed all kinds of charities that they hadn't developed yet. They expanded the stuff for kids, which, again, wasn't really so much a moving away from work with women, but actually I think it's quite tied to work with women, which is that which is to say that if single women at the time of the famine in the 40s and 50s are most crucial, what they see by the 50s, 60s, 70s is they see this placing out movement, and they see especially single mothers as being most vulnerable because they're most vulnerable to losing their kids. Mm-hmm. And so the nuns' movement to work with kids, I think, was fundamental to, again, them assessing the American experience and seeing a very different problem than they saw in Ireland, and a different problem in the 1870s than they did in the 1840s.
And how does this move through to become part of the political institutional fabric of New York City, and then, and I guess, largely expanding them throughout the United States? There's these in important points such as the Destitute Mothers Bill, widows' pensions, things like that.
Yeah. I'm sorry, so what was the question? I missed the question.
The question is, how what's happening in the 1870s and 1880s, how does this really transform itself to become part of the political institutional fabric of New York at this time?
Well, in the 70s and 80s, what you know and I know, what's so interesting about that period is that you start to get a massive labor movement for the first time. Mm-hmm. And with it, a very radical movement in the sense that, you know, they're really looking at capitalism for the first time. They're organizing. It's not to say that they're the first ones organizing as workers, but you start to get big groups like the Knights of Labor. And you get also radical movements that I discuss in my book. Somebody like a Father Edward McGlynn, who is really quite a radical priest. He worked in the shanty towns in Central Park, and he's arguing that, you know, individual property rights are absolutely wrong, and that the poor are as deserving as anyone else. They're not morally less than those people who have property, and that a really radical redistribution of wealth is what's called for. So nuns were in the middle of all this. Some of them supported people like McGlynn, were very radical. Some of them became more conservative over time. But what ends up happening in the 70s, 80s, 90s is that the recognition, even by American Protestants, that capitalism, in fact, it is going to go boom and bust. It's going to produce poverty. There needs to be something that is going to help those people who end up in poverty. Not necessarily, they're still not on the same page in regard to people who have been chronically poor. They tend to favor those people who lost a job they lost a job, and so they're only for a short time poor. But nonetheless, the rights of the poor are much more a part of what's going on in the 80s and 90s, and this is happening in Europe as well. There are massive movements that are for workers, recognizing that, you know, some basic give and take for workers is necessary. And this becomes so important in the American Catholic Church that, among other things, there is a delegation sent to Rome prior to Novorum. The papal discussion of work.
Yeah, Rerum Novarum, I believe, by Pius the Ninth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, but prior to that, American priests in the hierarchy went to Rome and said, if you basically say that workers can't organize, you're going to lose all of American Catholicism, because that was where the future was, that massive organization. And so you end up with a document from the Pope that is very balanced in the sense that it's anti-socialism, but it's also against capitalists who will make labor organizing illegal, which, of course, it remained illegal in the U.S. until the 30s, but it still was happening. So all of this is something that nuns are involved in. And And again, they could take different sides on it. They might not want to go as radical as somebody like McGlynn, but some of the nuns were as radical. So you're increasingly, by the time you get to the 90s, you're increasingly talking about an American populace that recognizes this class system that's developing and recognizing that capitalism is going to create great wealth, but also great poverty, and something's got to be done. And that's very different than the whole sense in the 19th century that if you could just get rid of these bad people who are clogging up the system, the Irish, then, you know, capitalism will work fine and we won't have poverty. And now it becomes more complex. And then on top of it, for the Irish, you end up with a whole new set of immigrants who come in. They're going through the experience that the Irish might have gone through 50 years ago. The Irish are getting a little bit of a leg up. But nonetheless, they're still in the working class. They're not quite middle class or well off at this point. So they're sympathetic.
Mm-hmm. And are the nuns fairly active in lobbying state government for these things such as women's pensions and the destitute mother's bill?
No, they're not. And it's interesting because I think that on the one hand, they're extraordinarily successful in pragmatic ways of getting money and services to the poor. On the other hand, the restrictions for nuns were on public voice. They did a lot of things that the public didn't know about. And if you were an American Protestant woman, you would have wanted to make the argument that, okay, ideologically we should do this because of XYZ. And then there would be a public debate about it. The Irish nuns don't want a public debate. They don't want a paper trail that's going to tell the Archbishop what they're doing. They want to sort of do it themselves. And what was your question? Because I'm getting off.
I'm just wondering to what, you know, direct or indirect role did the nuns have in playing and establishing these roles?
It's very indirect at this point.
Yeah.
The most direct thing that they did that was so amazing is they, you know, they're organized as convents. So they're organized as these groups of women who are giving all their labor collectively to this one project. And they're enormously efficient at it. So they provide the labor. Sometimes they will provide ideological justification for it.
Mm-hmm.
But more often than not, they have, once Irish men get political power, they kind of let nuns do what they want. That changes in the Progressive Era where there's a lot of regulations, the state changes, there's a lot mm-hmm. that comes in as checks against nuns' power. But for Catholic men, it wasn't so much that they were arguing the same things as nuns were, so much as they knew that getting money for them was at least going to keep the Catholic community okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the radicalism is only allowed when, and it's only visible when you can really see nuns on the ground doing the work.
Mm-hmm. There's one aspect we won't get a chance to talk to, but I want to turn people back to your book, Habits of Compassion, Irish Catholic Nuns and the Origins of New York's Welfare System. Is this tension between the nuns and the Catholic hierarchy that you had mentioned, that the nuns like to fly under the radar, so to speak, and you have a number of different interesting characters who serve as archbishop throughout the 1850s, 60s, and into the early 1900s that really kind of changed the dynamic of a lot of things. And
yeah.
We'll let our listeners kind of explore that through your own book. But one of the questions that I do want to finish up with here, and I love always asking this of my guests, and especially historians, because I love historical work because we can look back upon the human experience and then think about ourselves today. And so the question I have to you is that throughout this journey of research that you've done, is there anything that surprised you or changed the way you think about us here today in the early 21st century?
Oh, tons. I think one of the things, actually, I'll go back to your question about historians and methods. One of the things that surprised me, and I love to be surprised when I'm doing research, so I always tell grad students, you know, if you're not surprised in your research, then you're doing the wrong topic, because if you know already what you're going to say at the end of all this research, then why do it? And for me, what it really challenged me to do, let's say if I'm looking at somebody like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, she was very renowned in the 19th century. People collected her papers. Everybody was very concerned that, you know, everything she had written down be preserved. Irish nuns are exactly the opposite. They don't want what they are thinking to be written down, because, again, they are in a different structure. They don't want an archbishop around them. So for me, what was fascinating was that I could read books and books and books about small things that Protestant American women did at the time. And some of them were quite extraordinary, but they would write about them a lot. And it took me a long time as an historian to recognize how much nuns were doing, because I started to look away from texts and started to look at actually the institutions that they built. This is a great example, was the Foundling Asylum. The Foundling Asylum was to take in foundlings, infants who were abandoned, and they started in the 1870s, and they started with a small group who was doing this. And what these nuns, this is the Sisters of Charity under Sister Irene Fitzgibbons, they started recognizing that women really mostly didn't want to leave their kids. They wanted to stay with them. And so they started expanding a convent to make room for nursing mothers. Over the next 25 years, what becomes the Foundling Asylum is this enormous, enormous institution. It's a full city block between, I think it's Lexington and Madison on in the 50s. And it's what these nuns develop is an entire hospital that's a maternity hospital for women who can give birth, stay there, don't have to pay any money. They developed the first pediatric hospital in New York, connected to the Foundling Asylum, where the kids would go if they had problems. They had a system whereby they take wet nurses and they'd pay wet nurses to take a child for a couple of years, and they'd wait and see if the woman wanted her child back. Because what they were increasingly realizing is that, you know, women don't abandon their children because they don't care. They're abandoning their children because, for one reason or another, they couldn't keep them, either economically or because they'd be shamed. So it related to elite women as well. And what was amazing to me is that, you know, I went through all the records and I was reading all this stuff, and I was thinking of my research by those text pages. And then I was turning around and looking at this enormous, enormous place, the Foundling Asylum, where they fed, you know, 1,500 people a day. They housed unbelievable numbers of women and children. They actually were able to give a small stipend to these wet nurses who took in the kids. And so, to me, what was interesting is that having worked on a lot of Protestant women who write everything down, I was in dismay because I had no evidence. But of course, what these people who at the Foundling did without writing about it a lot was unbelievable. And so I recognized that my dependence on texts was really warping how I was seeing this, that these institutions had their own policies, their own set of effectiveness, an incredible budget, and they were able to affect the lives of thousands and thousands of women, and they didn't write a book about it. But they had an institution that worked for decades to be available to women. So when we as historians look at what we have as evidence, if we're only looking at those things that are texts where people claim a certain thing, we'd miss the story entirely. Instead, looking at a diagram of that entire block that has building after building after building, that's all about getting these poor people through a very bad period. But yet, there's not a lot written about it. It really made me rethink how to be an historian and how not to privilege text over everything else.
I think that's a very good lesson to learn. Those women religious did not write a book about it, but you did. And it's a really good book. It's called Habits of Compassion, Irish Catholic Nuns and the Origins of New York's Welfare System, 1830 to 1920. And I recommend that to our listeners. My guest today has been Maureen Fitzgerald. Maureen, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much, Tony. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.